Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org. We're delighted to have Mark Lagon with us today to talk about business and human rights. Ambassador Lagon is CFR's Adjunct Senior Fellow for Human Rights, and he is a professor at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, where he teaches ethics. From 2007 to 2009, Ambassador Lagon was U.S. Ambassador at Large at the State Department, directing the Office to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. Previously, he served as the State Department's Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Bureau of International Organization Affairs. He helped found the Global Business Coalition Against Human Trafficking and is the author of The Reagan Doctrine, Sources of American Conduct in the Cold War's Last Chapter. Welcome. Thank you very much for being with us, Ambassador Lagon. It would be great if you could get us started on talking about what is corporate social responsibility and do businesses like governments have human right obligations to uphold?
I'm delighted to be with you and looking forward to our discussion. One of the more slippery terms that we have in the international affairs field is corporate social responsibility. It's as important as it is hard to pin down. And a couple of images come to mind to people when they talk about a corporate social responsibility. Some think of businesses beginning to act like angels, and others think of kind of window dressing, that multinational corporations are trying to show that they are good actors. You recall the expression greenwashing, where some companies are accused of trying to look like they're improving their record on climate change when it's only window dressing. But the reality lies somewhere between businesses acting like angels and window dressing. It's important to look at this in the international relations field because we no longer have a world where governments or the international organizations that are made up of governments from the UN and World Bank are the dominant players in the world. Multinationals are absolutely crucial in governing the world. Even before we had the expression globalization, back when people in the 1970s were talking about interdependence in the world, it was becoming clear that multinational corporations were huge players in the way outcomes for collective action are brought about. So what should we think about business and human rights? Typically, in the UN and international law, it's been governments that have been seen as having the responsibility for upholding human rights. Businesses may have been concerned about being decent, but they didn't think they had a legal or basic moral obligation for protecting human rights like governments. Well, one really interesting figure in this field is John Ruggie, and I'm delighted that on the phone today we have Christine Bader, who worked very closely with him in these efforts. But John Ruggie, back when he had been a professor at Columbia, was wooed by the Secretary General Kofi Annan to be an advisor. And he helped Kofi Annan form a substantial code of conduct for businesses coming out of the UN, something called the UN Global Compact. It set out some voluntary principles for businesses on human rights, on labor, on the environment, and on fighting corruption in countries where they operated. A number of companies have signed up for those voluntary principles, but there's a strong sense that they needed to go farther than voluntary principles. So the UN's human rights body based in Geneva set up a mandate to create a special representative of the UN Secretary General to study what are the obligations of businesses and multinational corporations on human rights. And John Ruggie was assigned that job, and he's worked on it very intensively for a number of years, taking soundings with governments, with NGOs, with businesses all over the world. And he formed some guidelines on the obligations of business and human rights. This framework he calls the Protect, Respect, and Remedy framework. So basically, it addresses the question, what's the job of states and what's the job of businesses in dealing with human rights questions? The first idea that people must be protected in human rights, that's the state's duty. How governments need to protect the basic human rights of their people and set clear laws and guidelines for businesses about what their obligations are so that it isn't ambiguous. The second pillar, respecting human rights, refers to corporations' responsibilities. They need to make sure that their business operations and that their supply chains don't trample all over human rights. And the main principle there is they need to pursue due diligence. They can't just say that in their complicated supply chain, picture, for instance, ExxonMobil, the layers and layers of suppliers for all of its work to refine oil, it could, as a corporation, say, we're going to not worry about all the different suppliers and inputs into our supply chain because we could never figure out whether there's any exploitation occurring in that supply chain. But due diligence is an idea that John Ruggie fashioned, is that companies have to take responsibility for looking into their own business operations, checking them out, looking under the hood. And the final and third pillar of this human rights strategy that he fashioned, guidelines, is the idea of remedy. If people have had their human rights trampled upon, they need to be able to seek remedy. They need to have access to justice. They may go somewhere and get some sort of payment, some sort of improvement in their lot. And that is jointly the responsibility of governments and businesses. So governments must protect, businesses must respect with due diligence about their supply chains and business operations, and both must give opportunities for remedies for those who have their human rights harmed. So these principles were actually adopted by the UN Human Rights Council and then in New York at the UN General Assembly. And there's a working group following up on this. But these are actually principles that have now been adopted by the UN. Okay, just some tangible examples before we get into our discussion. Where does corporate social responsibility become a reality? Well, of course, there are those times when businesses resent when governments are telling them that they should not do business with dictatorial regimes, with regimes sponsoring human rights abuses, terrorism, weapons proliferation. It's not surprising that businesses don't want to implement or live by sanctions. But from South Africa under apartheid to Iran now, in the situation of nuclear proliferation, it is others, the UN and governments, who have had to determine that. But there are times where businesses have to make decisions for themselves. And I think it's an interesting case to look at internet companies in China. A number of internet companies, Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, operated in China, and they worked with the government as the government of China created a regime of censorship of the internet. And their basic thinking, Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, and others, was that they have to follow Chinese law when they do business in China. Censorship was acceptable if at least the Chinese people knew honestly what was happening, if they put a disclaimer that these were, you know, these search engines were in fact being censored. If they got out of the market, then others would jump in their place who had less, moral compunctions to do the right thing. If they didn't operate in China, then people would have less information. At least a censored internet, a censored set of search engines, was a better, more liberating situation for the people of China than otherwise. But Google decided, in particular, when it found that Gmail users were having their accounts hacked in an effort by the Chinese government to insert itself in their business, it decided it was going to change its policy. And it decided it would steer its users of its search engine in mainland China to its search engine in Hong Kong, where there was no censorship. Ultimately, it got into a dialogue with the Chinese government, and they came to a compromise. And that's an interesting example of a business doing the right thing and yet still cooperating with the government. Right now, people are given an opportunity to turn to the Hong Kong uncensored alternative, but they're given the default option of living by the government's rules. And many citizens in China, interestingly, are picking the censored version, perhaps worried that they're being watched. The last example I'd like to give is in the area of human trafficking. So I, for 2 years, headed the State Department Office to Combat Human Trafficking, that is, sex trafficking and forced labor. This isn't petty exploitation as a result of globalization. This is the extreme exploitation of people, of women, children, migrants, minorities. It's a huge phenomenon. The International Labor Organization suggests in a study it put out last summer that 21 million people are victims of forced labor and human trafficking. And while about 10% of those are at the hands of governments and militaries, whether it be in prison labor in China or armed rebels forcing people in Africa to become child soldiers, 90% of the 21 million human trafficking victims are in the private economy. So the world of the last 12 years or so, since the U.S. passed a law on this and the U.N. Formed the Palermo Protocol to fight human trafficking in the year 2000. It's had some progress. About three-quarters of the countries in the world have signed up to the UN treaty. About two-thirds of the countries in the world have put in place laws that prohibit human trafficking. But still, the problem persists. A U.S. Department of Labor report that comes out every couple of years indicates what goods are tainted by human trafficking and forced labor. And goods like rubber, pig iron, which is the input for steel, which goes into American cars coming out of Brazil, cocoa from West Africa, tantalum from conflict zones in Africa that goes into cell phones, these are all inputs into supply chains tainted by human trafficking. So governments, intergovernmental organizations like the UN, the World Bank, and nonprofits have been fighting human trafficking, but we need business at the table as well. I have myself been involved in a global business coalition against human trafficking, including some companies like Coca-Cola, Delta, LexisNexis, Microsoft, to try and bring business to the table. And these companies, just as an example, have decided that they want to share best practices with other companies so that they come to the realization that you want to prevent the worst forms of exploitation. If you don't have a rule of law in the countries where you're operating as businesses, you're going to be harmed. Your shareholders are going to be harmed. Your customers are going to be turned off. Not only do businesses want to avoid getting a bad reputation, they want to be seen as actors which are making for a better world and making for more prosperous societies. The gap discovered in 2007 that blouses that it was selling all over the world had little girls in sweatshops in India embroidering those blouses. And it was a terrible hit on their reputation. But what's interesting is they've been trying for 3 years to audit their supply chains and find problems. They have become much more focused on fighting this in their operations. And so I'd be happy to talk with you about some of these examples, businesses understanding that sanctions at times make sense, the Google decision in China, and in particular, businesses banding together to fight human trafficking, or those who haven't yet seen the light, as examples of the question of what are businesses' obligations on human rights. Let's have some discussion.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Mark. Let's open it up to the group for questions, and we want to give students first priority.
At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key followed by the one key on your touch tone phone now. Again, to ask a question, dial star one. Our first question comes from the Texas Women's University.
Interesting discussion. Now, for the human rights records, which are the countries that are, I guess, the worst offenders, and which might be the, poster childs or best practice examples?
Of companies?
Of countries.
And perhaps
organizations within those countries. And what might be the next practices to further this cause of human rights? Not best necessarily, since that would be contextual, but next practices.
Well, thinking of the context of what role business can play, what's interesting is two factors. The size of the economy in question, you know, is it China or is it Burma? And the degree to which the international community has come down with some sort of penalties or sanctions. Again, a good comparison, China and Burma. Until recently, in the opening up of Burma by its leadership, both of these countries in East Asia had very problematic human rights records. I mentioned forced labor. Well, of the 10% of forced labor that is in brought about by governments, in particular prison labor and the phenomenon of reform through labor of political prisoners, China is the bulk of that. In Burma, there was enormous repression of dissent, and then even targeted violence against particular ethnic groups by the military and paramilitaries, including sexual violence against the women of minority ethnic groups. So, the difference between these two cases, size of the economies, and the business world has been resistant to stand up to China's government because of how powerful the government is, and the economic opportunity that business thinks it has in China. Whereas this is more or less during 20 years of a hermit-like isolation by the government of Burma, more or less stepped out of that market. And it's only recently with the opening that it has returned. Governments haven't pursued sanctions on China because of the same reasons, size of the government and the size of the economic opportunity. But there was pretty strong consensus on Burma, perhaps because the sense was not much money was to be made. Those are two factors that you see, size of the government and the market in question, and the opprobrium put in place by public institutions in the form of sanctions.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Richard Stockton College.
Hi. With incidents like the Walmart Bangladesh fires, does the obligation for stricter regulations fall on single nations, or is an international organization needed to watch multinationals or states that don't effectively regulate?
Well, you know, one of the great problems in the world, and I've written about this for the Council on Foreign Relations, is the existence of laws and treaties with protections for employees and citizens and for human rights. But despite on paper those laws and treaties existing, they aren't implemented. And so who's the watchdog? If you look at the case of the fires in facilities in Bangladesh, clearly the first obligation is by the government in question. But increasingly, there's been a sense that the international community needs to at least be a watchdog, if not step in and enforce change. And so, you know, in that case, the International Labor Organization and others need to be a watchdog as well. I think the key here, though, is not whether it's a government or an international organization. When is it that business will see that it's not a bad press story that's the danger, but in fact a less profitable atmosphere in a country to work in that is its, should be its motivation? A company should see that a community that is safer, has more education for females, has more economic opportunity for its citizens will be in fact a better labor market or a better market to sell its products, like Bangladesh.
Thank you. Next question.
As a reminder, dial *1 to ask a question. Our next question comes from Al Akawane University.
Hello. How do you give the right to set with rights and the functionality of the Indian worldwide and the good
news?
Sorry, I'm not hearing you very well.
Right.
Hello?
Hi.
Hello? Can you hear at all?
I can hear you some.
Okay. The question a student has, how do you feel that the responsibility to protect, respect, and also provide the remedy will apply to the Maghreb region, given the stronger economies elsewhere? And do you think that if these countries were somehow to integrate themselves, that would put them in a stronger position in terms of enforcing these protections?
You're saying in the Maghreb region?
Yes.
Okay. Well, in terms of any region of the world, I think that it's going to require businesses and not just governments and the UN and international organizations to take the lead in these responsibilities. But I would agree with the premise of your question that the more the economies of the Maghreb, of Northern Africa in general, become integrated with Europe to the north, with the global economy, the better for profitability. And there needs to be a predictable rule of law for businesses to multinational businesses to operate in these atmospheres. And if there's a sense that labor exploitation could emerge in business operations and that it would stain the reputations of businesses, that's going to be a problem. But I do think the integration you describe will create an impulse for businesses to push forward with each of the three pillars. One, businesses insisting that governments be clearer about what the rules of the road are in the protecting of human rights. Businesses saying they actually should devote resources and time to accountability in their supply chains as the respecting human rights pillar. And then thirdly, working on remedies.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Pepperdine University.
So not to discount the importance of intervention action. But for example, in the business world, I mean, isn't there sometimes a tendency to overreact? I mean, what's the appropriate level of, you know, government intervention? For example, the UN. I mean, how realistic is it sometimes what they do? I mean, does it just create more bureaucracy for businesses to deal with, or does it actually make a difference? I mean, for example, your example of sweatshops, I mean, there is actually economic theory, for example, the work of Jeffrey Sachs, that says sweatshops aren't exactly human exploitation. It's sometimes just the overreaction of the international community.
Okay, well, two really good elements to that question. One is this notion that Sachs and some others, for instance, Nicholas Kristof, of the New York Times, has said in a piece called Two Cheers for Sweatshops, that in fact sweatshops, you know, hard factory labor situations for women in China are actually on balance a good thing because there are more economic opportunities despite some exploitative circumstances. I discount that view. I think it's to say that a migrant laborer is leaving a worse situation and so that we should accept gross exploitation wherever they move to, or that sweatshops are okay, I think that's problematic. But now, you ask a very good question. Will the UN or some other international organization inserting itself in the situation not really help and just create bureaucracy? Let me just, tell the story of Ruggie getting picked up. I'm not just telling you about Ruggie because I happen to have followed the story. I think the business community has been very focused on these guiding principles. When the British actually proposed the resolution that would create this position that Ruggie took on as special representative of the Secretary General, there was great concern in the business community and in the U.S. government that this would begin to insert the UN in a place it didn't belong, and begin to suggest that one of the more politicized bodies of the UN on human rights would be starting to speak to what businesses should do and not just governments. And to his credit, John Ruggie proved those of us who were skeptical wrong by engaging in dialogue and establishing something where if you follow the precepts of his guidelines, the answer doesn't lie with the UN. The answer lies with business and government talking to each other. So I think that it so far, the dialogue has moved in the right direction, despite my own profound skepticism that the UN should be the answer for solving these problems.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the Center on Rights Development.
I wanted to know what your opinion was on American businesses committing human rights abuses in foreign nations. For example, water drainage by the Coca-Cola company or American clothing companies who use sweatshop labor. We're a country that constantly lives in, some kind of turmoil, and we're always protesting, and aren't we responsible for somehow regulating that? Do you think it's even plausible for our government to regulate that in our own businesses?
Well, I was focusing earlier on this question of, is it the responsibility of government or the responsibility of business to protect human rights? Well, there's another way of asking this question. If you have a multinational corporation that's headquartered in the United States, should that company live by the laws and the rules in a country where it's operating? Say it's operating in Cambodia or in Ghana. Should it live by the rules set by the government there, or should it live by tougher rules, generally speaking, that are established by the U.S. government? If citizens are to, U.S. customers of the companies and shareholders are to push companies to do more, they need to decide, which norms the governments need to live by. But here, I think, you and I share a premise, which is that customers who buy things and those who own shares in companies, and so many people do own shares in companies. You know, all of our, you know, retirement plans, even relatively young people, include shares in companies. We have the power to say, hey, your supply chain may be tainted by exploitation. We won't accept that. That's why that list that the U.S. Department of Labor puts out of tainted products is powerful. It informs consumers and shareholders. I'd commend to you a resource on the web. It's imperfect, but it's very illustrative. It's called slaveryfootprint.org. You know the concept of your carbon footprint, having a sense of how much your lifestyle contributes to climate change. Well, some smart people, in particular a former musician, Justin Dillon, decided to create a resource where you would answer a few questions online about your lifestyle, and it would make a rough calculation of the number of people who are in slavery conditions in the world who support your lifestyle. It's very much what we used to call in my generation a back-of-the-envelope calculation, but that helps inform people about how their lifestyle as consumers may be on the backs of exploitation. Those are the most powerful voices of all, if people were willing to not buy a product if they thought it might be tainted with exploitation.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from the University of Puget Sound.
Hi. I was just wondering, what do you personally think is the best approach to encompass all businesses to adopt these human rights principles? Because I know small companies that take the next step to become a big company, they first start exploiting bad labor practices, such as like Apple and Gap and Nike. They exploit bad labor practices, and then later on, they show to the media that now we're not gonna do this, the bad labor practices, but they have already done it already. So what are some incentives?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the narrative you tell has frequently been the case. You know, so you get Walmart with all of its, you know, sort of famous allegations of exploitation, but then occasionally, you know, trying to do good. Walmart refuses to buy products based on cotton coming out of Uzbekistan because there is, you know, forced child labor in cotton picking. By the way, you know, remember our history of slavery and cotton picking. There's sort of poetic justice there. So even Walmart, you know, with a bad record, occasionally tries to come out, you know, and push in the direction of doing good. Nike had problems with the production of soccer balls with sweatshop labor in Pakistan, and then has taken up the cause of human rights, and even its foundation, the Nike Foundation, now promotes the opportunity for young women to work, you know, in the economies of the developing world. But I think occasionally your narrative happily doesn't pan out. Sometimes there are small companies from the very beginning which embed in their institutional culture, in their company culture, doing good before they grow huge. And I'll give you one example. I'm not on the payroll. They're not part of the business coalition that I'm, you know, I've helped put together, so that there's no bias here. But the Eileen Fisher Company, which is a women's apparel company, yeah, kind of, you know, funky Asian style clothes. Eileen Fisher goes to enormous lengths to make sure that its sourcing is not based on human trafficking, forced labor, or exploitation. And it hopefully, as that company grows, part of its profile will be that it is a decent company. Companies have been resisting living by some legislation that was passed in California that says if you have proceeds over $100 million a year, you need to post on the web what you're doing to check out your supply chain to make sure it doesn't have forced labor and human trafficking. Eileen Fisher went to great lengths to put in place their own accountability system and put it up on the web as a model for others, even though they're a tiny company. So hopefully we'll get to a world where the narrative is a little different from what you say and what I'm afraid has too often been the case.
So could a possible approach to this be that companies, when they on their websites or as a mission statement, they should state their supply chain, how they go about with their supply? Would that be something?
I think that would be a big help. Of course, it is a momentous task for a large company to reveal what's going on in its supply chain. Like I said, you know, before the Gap discovered there was brutal child labor in embroidering of its blouses in 2007, it had for 3 years been building up a system of 60 inspectors to go look at its supply chains around the world. So it's difficult. But I think transparency is the right way to go. And so this California law that suggests that companies, it doesn't mandate that companies have to do something about human rights. It mandates that companies have to say on the web what they're doing to check out their supply chains. Why is that good? Because if people know, citizens and consumers know, what good things some companies are doing, that's going to push other companies to do more. And I'm all in favor of national legislation to be just like that. And a couple of interesting people, as different as Senator Marco Rubio, the conservative from Florida, and Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney, a liberal from New York, are pushing for that California legislation to become national.
Next question.
Our next question comes from Northeastern University.
Hi. I was wondering, you talk about the UN and states and corporations. What do you think the role of institutional investors play in this? Norway's sovereign pension fund has $650 billion, and they're asking investees to disclose their impacts on tropical forests. I'm wondering what role investors, especially these transnational investors, can have?
I think this is very important, not just consumers. It perhaps is even more potent force than consumers and some threatened boycotts. I've been impressed by the potential weight of big, you know, retirement funds. A large state in the United States has all of its pension funds for public employees live by, you know, certain rules, it can be leverage. There are a number of actors out there who encourage shareholders and responsible investors to do the right thing. A couple of examples are the Calvert socially responsible investment firm, or an organization based in New York called the Interfaith Council on Corporate Responsibility. They organize letter campaigns on behalf of some shareholders to all the shareholders in a company. And so between those kinds of campaigns and getting some large investment funds, such as public employees in a particular state, there's quite a bit of leverage there.
Thank you. Next question.
As a reminder, you can dial *1 to ask a question. Our next question comes from Arizona State University.
Hi, you mentioned that businesses can be more profitable when they operate in more predictable legal environments, and when those environments have better labor practices, higher rates of education, other things that we deem relative to human rights, and those all often translate to higher profitability. But what types of things can businesses do to be more proactive in order to improve those environments that they operate in, as opposed to just waiting for those to come from the top?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think, again, this returns to a premise that of a paper I wrote for the Council on Foreign Relations about the rule of law internationally. Very often, you know, there are lots of laws in place or treaties that have been ratified by countries, but that's just on paper. And so But I think that should be the focus of businesses, that those laws being implemented. One of the most problematic situations around the world is corruption. Poorly paid police, immigration officials, and bureaucrats often supplement their income. It's a really nice way of putting it. They take bribes. And they don't implement the law that's on the books. And businesses, there's a temptation to engage in bribing so that the some exploitative conditions are not found or stopped. But in fact, businesses need to create a situation of corruption being wiped out. And here there is a real convergence of interests. Google found that in India it was very eager to protect its intellectual property rights and wanted to fight corruption, but also discovered, well, maybe it should get in the business of fighting for rule of law to prevent forced labor and human trafficking. It goes together.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Christine Batter with Columbia University.
Hi, everybody, and hi, Mark. Thank you so much for that terrific overview and for great answers to the questions. I wanted to add a couple of quick points and then pose a question to you and to the group. First of all, on the role of investors, there's a report that's just been released this week that includes a couple of the organizations that Mark mentioned, Calvert and ICCR. It's called Investing the Rights Way. And you should be able to, that should be enough to Google it, that will answer some of the questions of how investors can encourage companies to meet their responsibility to respect human rights, which does indeed play into, I think, linking that up to the question of what's the appropriate level of government intervention and what's the appropriate role of the UN and the guiding principles, because what a lot of people ask is, well, great, we've got these guiding principles. Well, so what? They're not hard law. But the point is that, as Mark pointed out, the guiding principles were developed with so much consultation from all of these different stakeholder groups and everyone from the American, the Chamber of Commerce to Human Rights Watch to various governments gave input and saw their input reflected so that now they feel ownership. So companies are now using the guiding principles to mitigate their risks. NGOs and investors are using the guiding principles in their advocacy with companies and going to them and saying, hey, here's an emerging standard. Can you tell us how you're in compliance? And governments are incorporating the guiding principles into their new policies, whether it's their listing requirements for stock exchanges or what have you. And Mark, I'm glad you brought up the Gap example, because I think the punchline to that story is, yes, they got a bad news hit on it, but the reaction drew upon the goodwill that Gap had built up over the years of working on this issue. So they had people like Mary Robinson, the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, standing up and saying, hey, the Gap has been working really hard to try to address this issue, and if anything, it just shows how endemic it is. And if any company, big company, says that they don't have child labor in their supply chain, they're probably not looking hard enough. So I think the Gap case actually shows how good it can be for a company to be proactive, as one of the other questions said, and get out ahead of the issue.
This prompts a story on my part. I was involved in helping businesses form this Global Business Coalition Against Human Trafficking, and I went with the companies that were already signed on to doing it, like Microsoft and Coca-Cola and LexisNexis, to talk to other companies. And I found the most pertinent to the case of the Gap you mentioned, the most cautious person in any multinational corporation is their top lawyer, mm-hmm. their chief counsel. They don't want to make promises publicly about checking out their supply chains and saying that they're doing more, because they're afraid that if something is found that's exploitative in their supply chain, there's going to be litigation, there's going to be a suit, and that there's going to be a larger award against the company that they're hired as a lawyer to protect because they've been promising that they've been doing things. And we need to create a situation in which companies feel that if they are trying to suss out problems in their supply chain, even if it isn't perfect, that it's every bit of effort that they make puts them closer to a situation of safety, of their reputation. Otherwise, they'll have, like these chief counsels I've met with, a kind of ostrich approach. Let me clarify, by the way, that in the pre-reading that we suggested, that one of them comes from Christine Bader. She now teaches for Columbia University, but when she was with the Kennan Institute for Ethics at Duke, and she has did work on business and human rights, and included in the reading is a piece on the Ruggie principles. Christine was really John Ruggie's right-hand woman in putting together the draft of these principles and in that soundings process, and she's a great resource. Thanks for joining the conversation.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Next questioner.
Our next question comes from Richard Stockton College.
Corporate social responsibility is thought of by many companies in terms of public relations or something they address at a superficial level. Do you think that is starting to shift on a larger scale?
It is. I think increasingly there is a move from corporate social responsibility being public relations to actually being incorporated into the core culture of companies. It has to be. It has to have patrons in what's called the C-suite of a company. You know, the CEO, the COO, those people at the top have to be bought in. And interestingly, if you look at multinational corporations, where they put CSR varies. Sometimes it's in the public relations marketing department. That's usually a bad sign. It means it's probably, you know, meant to be PR. They could be attached to the lawyers. They could be attached to human resources because they realize that the pride of employees will be increased if they feel their company is doing good and the employees are engaged in the effort to respect human rights. Companies have found that, such as the Manpower Corporation, a global human resources firm, retention of employees is much more durable if they're proud of their company's corporate social responsibility. And then the companies don't have to spend money on doing searches and training new employees.
Thank you. Next question.
Our next question comes from Texas Women's University.
Very, very intriguing discussion. I have one last question, and that is about the extended supply chain. There was some discussion earlier about the supply chain companies or subcontractors be disclosed by the company, but when we have an extended supply chain and we have subcontractors and the chain continues, it becomes hard. For instance, a company like Boeing would have in excess of 3,500 suppliers, and how would that be even fathomable to get this information to the stakeholders?
It is extraordinarily difficult, but we can't just wipe our hands clean of the effort. I mean, one beginning part of the process is a supplier code so that the main company has an agreement, an understanding that it signs with its suppliers that they are responsible for the accountability of their sourcing, and that then they in turn have other sub-suppliers and subcontractors that they're responsible. But some companies at the headquarters think, okay, well, as long as they have those agreements on the books, then that offloads the responsibility to the suppliers down the chain. That responsibility needs to stay with the main company itself. By the way, I just want to note that another part of this is your source of labor. There's a lot of migrant labor in the world, and there needs to be high standards for the sourcing of labor. There are a lot of legal guest workers, not irregular migrants, not undocumented workers, but legal migrant workers who are essentially in debt bondage, that they have very high fees extracted from them by scurrilous labor recruiters, like people in Nepal or the Philippines who are offered a job as a maid or as a construction worker in a Persian Gulf state. The NGO Verite, which is based in Massachusetts, works closely with businesses to look at the source of their labor, and in fact has put out some great best practices on the web, and I commend them to you.
Thank you. Next question.
For any final questions, please dial star 1. Our next question comes from Jen N. with Columbia University.
Yes, hi. This was a very great, fascinating, and informative session. I'm just wondering, as far as change is concerned, I feel that you need to do work at top down and bottom up. And although I completely understand about the international laws, really what as consumers can we do? And I'm always struck by, you know, people who are at the UN shouting about what certain countries and companies aren't doing. But the reality is if there isn't demand, then they wouldn't be creating these products.
Right,
and
exactly.
I'm just one example is the iPhone. I mean, why is it that any iGadget comes out? I mean, New York, which is where I am, the line is out the door, and I don't think anybody will pass up the opportunity to get the new product. But I'm just, you know, reminded of what had happened a couple of months ago about the factories. So how can we get more of consumers who clearly, if they don't buy the product, the companies will also rethink their supply chain?
Well, yeah, there's a great irony when further revelations that came out a couple months ago, as you were mentioning, of the factories run by the partner of Apple in China, Foxconn, having extremely onerous labor conditions. A lot of the activists, labor activists, human rights activists, who were tweeting or engaging in the social media to complain about this problem were probably doing it on iPhones and iPads. So if people aren't willing to, you know, boycott or forsake the product, how do they, you know, make their voice heard? I think it's ultimately people need to be willing to, you know, vote with their pocketbook, with their wallet. There's always been this discussion, by analogy, of child labor in the cocoa supply chain in West Africa, in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire. And people have said, well, what if you could have chocolate bars that say on them that they are slavery-free or that they're child labor-free? And is it only a certain set of people, you know, with apologies that, you know, your basic solid NPR listener and, you know, Starbucks coffee shopper who might be willing to spend a little bit more money for the candy bar that has the slavery-free certification on it? I think we need a bit of a culture change so that we look at the very question you're looking at on demand. That people won't accept cheap products. What the Gap said in 2007 was, well, of course there's going to be exploitation in the supply chain. If people want cheap products, it's going to happen. Well, we need to sort of change that incentive structure.
Thank you. Next question?
Our next question comes from Coastal Carolina University.
Hi, I personally don't have much faith in people. So if we have incentives to help with companies that change their supply lines, if that doesn't work and a company continues to abuse that, should sanctions be put on it? And if so, should it be from the UN? Maybe a country can refuse their business? Is there anything that can be done in that way?
Well, I think that there are basic legal requirements for companies. So either a host nation, or if a multinational that's headquartered in an advanced industrial country is operating in a developing country, obviously governments need to hold them to account. But it's very often the other way around, that the companies ought to be holding those governments to account. But there ought to be, in the cases of gross exploitation, human trafficking, forced labor, the worst forms of child labor, we have had treaties and laws against these things since the early 20th century. This isn't a gray area of difficult work conditions. This is pretty enslaving circumstances. In those cases, there ought to be strong penalties enforced. It's interesting. Let me give you an example. A really honorable effort has been made in Brazil to fight forced labor. In the Amazon, there's actually quite a bit of forced labor. There's an estimate of 25,000 forced laborers in Brazil. And the government does a pretty good job. Over the last several years, it actually has Ministry of Labor inspectors who go out and look in factories and in the fields for forced laborers, and they have actually rescued, somewhere between 3,000 and 5,000 forced laborers a year. But only 10% of the cases were prosecuted last year. Last year, the U.S. Human Trafficking Report indicated that in Brazil, a country committed to fighting forced labor, only seven perpetrators were convicted. Three had sentences commuted to community service, and four served short sentences in halfway houses, not even formal prisons. There has to be enforcement. These are the cases of forced labor that are, the worst. If the worst cases are actually punished, then I think the incentive structure will change for the more gray area exploitation.
Thank you very much, Mark, and everybody on the call. Unfortunately, we are out of time, so I appreciate all your questions, your presentation. I think it was a terrific hour, and I'm sure the group will agree, so we appreciate it. Our next call will be on Thursday, March 28th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time with Shannon O'Neill, our Senior Fellow for Latin America Studies on U.S.-Mexico relations. So I hope you will join us for that. I encourage you to follow us on Twitter at CFR_academic for information on resources and upcoming events. And I hope that you will submit a question to our experts that will be answered. You can access it, the submission form, on our website at CFR.org. So I hope you will consider doing that as well. So, Mark, thank you again. We look forward to continuing your work, and we appreciate your service in the government, and it's exciting to have you on board here at the Council.
Well, Irina, you do a great job making the Council a resource for dialogue with people far beyond the New York headquarters or the Washington satellite offices of the Council. It's a delight being involved with multiple campuses at once as a professor, and I'm happy to hear from any of you with further questions or wanting to do further reading or dig into this more.
Great. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.